This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, Chinese blogger, and writing my name in cursive is my signature move. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinospice.com, and licks things to claim them as his own. Do you find it hard to remember characters? We all do. In this episode, John and I discuss a method that has helped countless masses of people remember characters. Guest interview is with Chris Max. He is a famous YouTuber that you may not have heard of because all of his videos are in Chinese and made for Chinese audiences. He has a great story on how he achieved a high level of Chinese proficiency and rose to internet fame in China. All this and more, let's get to it. John, I'm looking at you at your beady eyes.
Yeah, I always need more sleep.
He's blinking them for me. If you're wearing mascara, they look very full. All right, anyway, today we have a great podcast for you, everyone. Before we get into the subject, we have a review.
Okay, I suppose you're going to read that for us.
I am going to read it. This is from Kei Chung from Australia. It's a long one. He says, great tips for learning Chinese. You Can Learn Chinese lives up to its name. Listen to each podcast to find out why Jared and John say it's perfectly feasible to learn Chinese. Each episode typically starts with Jared and John discussing an aspect of learning Chinese. Two, has a fun rave or rage. That was actually rant or rave section, although sometimes, John, you're raging, I think.
I think you rage more than me.
Three, introduces a graded learner book, graded reader book. And four, has an interview with someone about their experience learning Chinese. I always learn something from each episode. Some great tips from J&J are, one, read, read, read. Two, progress from reading words versus characters to reading sentences versus words to reading passages versus sentences and to reading books versus passages. And three, work out your personal motivation for learning Chinese. That's very important. But listen to the podcast for yourself. See if you have a different set of top three tips for learning Chinese. Thanks, Kei Chung from Australia. Appreciate it.
All right. So today we're going to cover a topic which is kind of uniquely Chinese. We're talking about You Can Learn Chinese, and we frequently talk about reading Chinese. So all of that kind of revolves around that special thing that China's got, which is the Chinese character. And we've talked about Chinese characters before, but today I wanted to talk a bit about the structure of Chinese characters and how understanding the structure properly can either help us or hurt us on our journey for learning Chinese. So you ready for this, Jared?
I am ready, John. Hit me.
All right. So first of all, let me just ask you, before you started learning Chinese, what was your perception of Chinese characters? Was it intimidating? What did you think about it?
Oh, intimidating. They looked like spooky animals to me. In fact, when I first came to China, I had a good friend named Vaughn, and he spoke very good Chinese. I had told him, like, I was just going to learn Chinese, but I wasn't going to take the time to learn characters. And Vaughn said, he says, yeah, Jared, I think you could do it. Spend some time on it. So I was like, oh, okay, I did. And yeah, so it totally changed. But I was originally just going to say, hey, it's too complicated. I'm not even going to take the time.
So when you were originally considering possibly learning characters, what kind of endeavor did this seem like to you? Just like a massive mountain of things you had to memorize or what?
Oh, absolutely. I just was like, how am I ever going to learn all these characters? And I mean, that is somewhat a good argument, right? But there's, you know,
there are a lot.
But you can learn. You can learn them. And I've learned, you know, thousands of characters. But I wasn't sure how to even go about it at the beginning. I did do flashcards, and I did just sat down. It was like handwriting stuff. There were a lot of different ways I learned characters. But yeah, I wasn't sure exactly the best way to tackle it.
All right. Well, the thing that I've noticed about a lot of learners of Chinese is that their kind of assumptions about how it works to learn characters tend to fall into one of two extremes, and they're both kind of wrong. So the first extreme is that, oh, Chinese characters are just a bunch of strokes, and you just kind of memorize all those strokes, and each character just kind of memorize a bunch of stuff. It's like memorizing a phone number or something. You just memorize all this stuff, and then you keep going, and you do 10 a day until you learn 10,000 characters. So it's just very rote, very focused on memorization. All right, so that's the first extreme. The other extreme would just be, oh, well, see, it's not really just a bunch of random strokes. Like, actually, there's a system to it. And then once you learn the system, it's like this beautiful art that just like falls into place and everything makes sense. And like you can just anticipate how to write a character after you see something, you know?
I love how you're painting this picture. I'm smiling through the microphone at both of these stories because they're both ridiculous, right?
Right. They're both extremes, and they're both kind of wrong because they're extreme. But the good news is that they're also both kind of right, which actually is good news. So there is a system, and you really have to learn the system because it helps you a lot. And the human memory can't really handle all that memorization of strokes without some kind of system to help you learn it, to make sense of it. And it's also not just a whole bunch of strokes that you're memorizing. So like imagine that learning Chinese characters was just memorization of tons of strokes. It's almost like trying to learn the first like 1,000 decimal places of pi.
Yeah, that'd be hard.
It's just brutal, right? You just have to memorize everything and there's no rhyme or reason. You know, it's irrational, you might say, pi. And with Chinese characters, it's not totally irrational because you start to build these structures within each character, which can then recombine and make other characters. So for me, my experience learning Chinese, I think I kind of started out the same as you, seeing it as, oh, you just got to learn them and just got to write some characters and learn them. And I didn't think too much about like structure or whether or not it was all going to start to make sense. But when I was still learning Japanese, and this was in Japan before I started learning Chinese, this was back in 1996 or 97.
You're dating yourself, John.
Well, I'm mortal. And I found this book in the library in Japan, and it was by James Heisig, and it was called Remembering the Kanji. So kanji is the Japanese word for Chinese characters, right? And so the Heisig method was something that was totally new to me, and it was super exciting because of what he did.
Now, I've heard of the Heisig method before, or I've heard of this guy, but I really don't know much about him, and I've never really used his methods, at least knowingly. So what is this all about?
All right, so let me back up just a little bit, because when you start to learn characters, you learn about this thing called a radical. And if you don't know much about radicals, it's basically like a little part of the character that repeats a lot in different characters, and it helps you identify characters. It also helps the Chinese classify characters before they had pinyin, before they had any way of classifying characters. So you know, these little things that appear in characters, these little parts, like often it's the left-hand side, you know, like the person radical, the water radical, all this stuff. So that's useful. It's kind of a structure. But the thing with the radicals is it's sort of arbitrary. Like you can see lots of different things that could be a radical, but only one is the radical for this character.
Yeah. And from what I understand, isn't the term radical somewhat of a misnomer? I think I've read some places saying that it's not truly radical because it's bushel, right? That's what we say in Chinese. But radical may be a little actually different or a looser term.
Well, the issue is that the term radical gets used in a different way than is useful nowadays. So radical was the term used to refer to how we classify characters for the dictionary. The Kangxi Dictionary was like the super dictionary that organized all the characters, you know, by radical and by stroke order. Nowadays, we don't like count strokes as much and look up characters in paper dictionaries. So it's better to just be like, oh, yeah, I recognize the left half, and then on the right half, there's this thing on the top and this thing on the bottom. If you can recognize all the components, that's actually more useful. So nowadays, we often say component, and sometimes people say radical, not realizing that they're bringing in all this baggage of like, you know, ancient dictionaries and all this. But actually, component is probably a safer word because you can talk about, you know, this character has five different parts, and there's the left side and the top left and the top right and the bottom left and the bottom right, and you're not bringing in all this like weird Kangxi ancient stuff.
Well, thanks for clearing that up or confusing it more, either or.
So I don't like the word radical. I like to use components. All right, the thing with radicals is they're somewhat arbitrary and they're also kind of confusing. So getting back to James Heisig, what he did was he looked at all the radicals. And he said, I don't care if this is the official radical for a character. These are the building blocks of characters. Oh, by the way, here are some other ones that are not radicals, but I see them all the time. So I'm going to include these. And he changed the name. He didn't call them radicals, didn't call them components. Doesn't really matter what he called them. I don't think we want to get into that. But he said, I'm going to assign a meaning to each of these. And when it makes sense, I'm going to use the original Chinese meaning. But when it doesn't make sense, I'm going to use a meaning that makes sense for me. And so sometimes, you know, you have these different Chinese character components. It's like four different ways of writing the same thing, like four different ways of writing hand. Or here's the three-stroke water radical, and here's the two-stroke water radical. So that doesn't really help you memorize stuff. But with Heisig, he's like, nope, I'm going to keep everything separate and distinct, and he gave everything his own meanings, and then he started creating stories. Like, why are these five components together? What is the story that I need to create so that I can remember what this character means? And so he used his imagination, applied it to the characters in a way that made sense to him, and then bam, he started memorizing hundreds and then thousands of characters without having to write them a million times, which was the conventional wisdom.
Okay. Now, how does that differ from, I think the, one of the terms is mnemonics? Because on one of our podcasts, we had Phil Crimmins from Mandarin Blueprint, and he was talking about how they're using mnemonics in their program to help people learn characters, and it kind of went to a situation what you're describing where, you know, oh, I can learn maybe, you know, 10 or 50, but no, to like learning hundreds like very quickly.
Yeah, so that idea of using mnemonics to learn characters ties right into the Heisig method. One of the things that Heisig identified that a lot of people don't always get right, including myself, is that you want to be consistent. So if you learn the history of a character, you might find, oh, in this character, this part came from that. But in that character, it looks exactly the same, but actually it has a totally different history. And you can learn that history, and if you find it fascinating, great. But if you're just trying to remember the characters, all these histories that have like, you know, different stories for what looks like the same component, it gets really confusing. So that's where being consistent, like this component always means this in my system. And then what it means could have roots to Chinese character history, or maybe it's just a mnemonic. It's a story that you like.
So this is to help you remember the meaning of a character. Is that correct?
Right. You remember the components, and then the components, you make some kind of crazy story in your head, and then that helps you remember the meaning.
Okay. But let's go a little step further, because you know, one of the challenging things about Chinese characters, of course, is that we don't just have meaning. We also have the pronunciation, and then you have the curveball of the tone aspect have to attach to it. So does the Heisig method help us to also attach meaning or remember those other aspects of a character?
I think it has been expanded to include that. It originally didn't. Since Heisig came up with his method, a lot of other people have kind of taken the idea and sort of adapted it. So you might not even realize that, you know, this book by Tuttle or this book by, you know, some other publisher, they're actually using their own version of the Heisig method. I've also seen apps that do the same thing. I know Skritter has mnemonics. One of the ways that those can sometimes kind of fall down is if they give you the mnemonics, but they try to give you everything. So like rather than coming up with some kind of story that helps you remember, they're just giving you all these random components that someone else came up with. And it's like just trading a bunch of random things for a bunch of different random things. And now you have to remember those. It's good to kind of make it personal. That was Heisig's own recommendation. Once you assign meaning to these components, you're going to want to, you know, like maybe this component is your, like your girlfriend. And then when you see your girlfriend appear in characters, you're like, oh, yeah, that time she did that thing. That was hilarious. And like, it actually helps you remember the character. So that's personal. It doesn't work for other people.
Just don't tell her that she reminds you of this component of a character.
Well, I'll leave that up to you. Maybe it's flattering. I don't know.
All right. Well, I also want to hear, John, like, how does like the Heisig method refer to those two extremes scenarios you created at the beginning of our discussion here? You know, like, oh, it's full art and everything, and they'll just come together versus, you know, like, I just need to learn all the strokes.
All right. So if we accept that components are useful, then you're kind of rejecting this idea that it's a bunch of strokes and you're just memorizing it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that using the Heisig method or like a ton of mnemonics with meanings assigned to all the components makes it a fully perfect system. Because if someone else made up all the mnemonics for you, you're probably going to have trouble remembering it. So that doesn't make it a perfect system. In my mind, what makes it a perfect system is it's interesting to you. You get kind of pulled into it. You start assigning some of your own meanings to some of the components, and then you start making your own stories. And that's what makes it work really well for each individual. So like when I was originally looking at the Heisig method, I really liked the idea, but then some things kept nagging at me like, I really don't like how he assigned this meaning to this particular component. Like, obviously it should be this. And so, you know, wanting to make those changes, making it personal really helps.
Well, that makes sense. And I think what's interesting here about this method is that it's specifically designed to adapt to your own system, things that help you remember how to remember the characters.
It's got that room for you to fill in your own personal details that make it relevant to you. But at the same time, this organization is kind of built into the system, right? Like people that make that mistake of thinking it's just a bunch of strokes that you have to memorize, they're overlooking that Chinese is a system. There are like phonetic components and meaning components in almost every character. And it's not a perfect system, but if it didn't have this like organization, this inherent structure to it, then Chinese people themselves wouldn't be able to remember all those characters.
Okay, all right, so the Heisig method, that sounds like something that's really helpful. But I mean, there are a lot of other ways to help us to remember characters. So, I mean, what are some of these other ones that you've come across, John?
Well, that's the thing. There kind of really is one way, and everyone has their own spin on it. Like occasionally I see a website that's like, revolutionary new way to learn Chinese characters. Come learn with us. Sign up now, blah, blah, blah. And then you start looking at it, it's like, wait a minute, this is just like, either they're calling them radicals or they're just character components. And they're grouping characters by components, or they're giving you stories with the components and creating mnemonics. They're all kind of just piggybacking on what is inherently part of the structure of Chinese characters. Have you seen something that's totally different, Jared? I feel like everything falls somewhere in that territory.
One of the methods we've come across, and we even talked on the podcast some episodes ago, was like Chinesey, you know, using pictures ingrained with the characters to help you remember the meanings. So, I mean, I've seen that. Everyone seems to kind of have their special new spaced repetition algorithm to help you to not forget them. But aside from that, just like rote repetition or maybe attaching images, like actual illustrations and pictures to them, I haven't seen a lot of other methods aside from what you've been talking about.
Well, the core is that you can break down characters. They have a structure, right?
Yeah.
And then where people go from there, you know, that can vary.
But also one thing just about characters in general is it seems like that the Heisig method, that's, you know, that's really helpful to help you kind of get some of these characters on your belt. But also in the experience is that you just there is going to just take that amount of rote memorization. Even if you remember all the components and stuff, you're just going to have to see that character again and again in context to really have kind of instant recall for the meaning and the pronunciation of that character.
That's true. It does take time and it definitely takes effort. But the thing I like about it is that rather than taking that time and effort and putting it to writing the character over and over again, if I just sit down, I break it down and be like, okay, what are these components? Do I know what these mean? Have I seen these components in other words? Do I have stories that are relevant to this? You know, have I ever memorized this before? Is there a phonetic component? I just really break it down. I have to pull out a dictionary and look all this stuff up, right? Something useful, whether it's Pleco or whatever. And I spend time on that. And then I might even be spending time being like, man, I have to come up with a story related to these things. Like, I have no idea how to make a story. But eventually I do. And because I spend that time and effort, then I can remember the character. So for me, I'd much rather spend the time and effort on breaking down the character and eventually creating a story than on writing it 50 times. Because like at the end of the day, you wrote it 50 times, but there's no guarantee that's going to hold like a month later, you know?
So kind of what I'm taking away from this is that, you know, this is something that's going to help you to retain the meaning, you know, faster. But the sooner you can retain the meaning and even the pronunciation, the sooner you can go on to other things like reading. And that's why we have characters, right, is reading and, of course, writing. And if it's in your memory well enough, you can actually use it. You can start using it as comprehensible input, and you've leveraged it for output.
Yep. Actually, one thing Heisig did, which was kind of extreme and crazy in my opinion, was he learned a bunch of characters without actually knowing any words that use the characters. He learned the characters all by themselves. And I don't think that's really a good idea, and you don't have to do that. Like if you're learning to speak Chinese and you're also learning characters, then they're going to overlap quite a bit, not 100%, but quite a bit. And that's good. Like the meaning and the form, you want those to be overlapping and matching up, and that'll help everything reinforce each other and help it stick in your memory.
Oh, this is really good. It's just great to hear about this. And I think anyone listening, you know, hey, this is definitely worth a look to help you, you know, start acquiring the meaning and understanding the new characters. You know, all the other things that maybe you might be trying and other people do too, sometimes writing characters and reading stuff, that stuff is also, that has its place. You know, on this podcast, we've always been kind of dogging on the concept of, you know, writing characters. But there is a place for it, right? And I think, you know, writing, you know, it helps you kind of see that breakdown components, right, frankly. But what I'm not for is filling big notebooks full of characters, right? But learning the function, the order, how they all kind of work together is great. But there's a lot of people, too, that will say like, oh, you know, I wish I could learn how to write Chinese. I'm like, well, you know, writing, handwriting Chinese, that is a whole nother skill. And that has its levels of fluency, being able to fluently write characters is a whole nother skill, and unless you're super motivated, and you, or you have some real reasons you need to do that, I don't recommend it because it can beat you down.
But instead of having notebooks filled with characters that you've written over and over, what if you have notebooks with character breakdowns and like little comics that show the stories that you made up to remember the characters? That would actually be kind of cool.
That would be cool. And that's probably more effective, and it's something you could go back and look at and you'd be like, oh, yeah, I remember this. You know, sometimes writing something down, it retains it in your memory. So even you may not have to go back and look at it. You just remember it because you actually wrote it down. And I think that's one of the reasons why people want to write characters by hand, because they think it – and it does. It does help you retain it in your memory. But we need to go beyond just remembering those individual character particles. And that's just a reminder for any listeners saying that you can learn all those characters. And John, both of us, we were advocates of this all the time, is that you may know the character, but you need to understand how it's used in context. And you need to see it in natural language, because otherwise the meaning becomes very isolated, right? And it's very siloed, and you don't understand how it relates to other characters. And you don't understand how to use it. Otherwise, you just it becomes unusable for you. You know, listeners, remember this, that these are excellent to help you remember characters, but remembering the character is not enough for fluency. Fluency also takes the ability to instantly recall things.
Right. So when you say remember a character, I imagine you're thinking of like, oh, I have my flashcard deck, and then I look at this character, I spend 1 or 2 seconds, and then I remember that it means this, and then I go on to the next character and repeat. So you're talking about that kind of remembering, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And to think about this, if you pick up anything in English or whatever your native language is and you see a sentence, what if you had to take 1 second to read, or even half a second to read every word? That's very slow reading. It's very laborious. And the same thing for a Chinese. You need to be able to, you know, instant recall, be able to see that character unless you instantly know it. And so that's what's really critical in progressing towards fluency. And it's great because like there's so many methods like this out there that are going to help you acquire understanding and meaning. And if you have a good method like the Heisig method that's going to help you get there sooner, you're going to be able to get to that fluency practice sooner. And in the course, you're going to get to fluency faster.
All right, totally. So once you know the characters, you know, you can start working on your reading speed. But if you want to start to really lock those characters into your memory, remember that rote is probably not the best way. So if you want to look up Heisig, we're going to have links in the show notes. But the spelling is H-E-I-S-I-G. And you want to look at components. And it's also good to know the structure of different characters. We can give you a link to that too. So there's only a limited number of ways that you can combine components and make characters. And that is a godsend, because if there were an unlimited way to arrange these components, it's almost as bad as having an unlimited number of components.
And note, it is Heisig, not Heisenberg.
Yes, Heisenberg is Breaking Bad, or physics, whatever.
Yes, we're not doing meth here. All right, now we've got a word from our sponsor. And our sponsor today is...
Mentoring Companion.
Imagine that. All right, today we are talking about Great Expectations. It's a level 2 book, 450 character level.
And this book is very special because it actually is 2 parts. So parts 1 and 2 taken together are the longest story that you can read in Mandarin Chinese as a kind of intermediate level learner. And it's a pretty good story because...
Honestly, John, I got to read this story. I kind of headed up this, I guess, the story, the plot outline for this one. This is a story that if you read it when you're in high school or when you're younger, read it again when you're older because it gets better with age.
Because it's a Charles Dickens classic. That's
it
what I was looking for.
It is a Charles Dickens classic. You know, Charles Dickens wrote 2 stories that were kind of a parallel to each other. One was David Copperfield. But it was like David Copperfield made all the right choices in his life. And it was later said that Charles Dickens wrote that story because it kind of projected the life he wished he would have lived. But Great Expectations more paralleled his life, where you make bad choices, you know, your pride and everything, and you brought a lot of pain in your life, but then there's kind of the redemption at the end. It's a wonderful story. And so if you haven't read it yet, you can read it in Chinese for the first time. And it won't take you as long to read it in Chinese because we actually spent a lot of time condensing the story. I mean, the original story has 3 parts and it's something like, you know, 60 chapters. I don't remember, but we took all that and we combined so many characters and plot lines into a 2-book story, so you can read it.
But it is still a good story.
Fantastic story. The end of the book, right? The last 2 sentences was pretty much just directly translated.
It's a good ending.
It is a very good ending. It's just like, oh, it touches your heart. And you're like, that's great. And I remember one of our readers, he sent us an email saying like he was like crying at the end. like in Chinese, and he was like crying in Chinese. You know, it was fantastic. So, anyway, so you can go out there and get it today. Great Expectations. You can get it on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, or wherever you get your books.
That is level 2, 450 characters.
All right, now we have rants and raves. I'm going to start with our rants and raves.
I'm ready.
My rave is Stroke Order.
What a kiss up.
Wait, we were talking about characters today, but no, really, like, my rave is Stroke Order.
My rave is Confucius.
Well, congratulations. All right. But no, really, like, I used to bag on Stroke Order. And honestly, if you guys check out my meme account, on Instagram, our Mandarin Companion meme account, I make a lot of memes about Stroke Order and I kind of bag on everything. But realistically, though, I think Stroke Order, it's wonderful because it helps you remember the characters better. There's always like a way to write a box. There's a Stroke Order 1, 2, 3 stroke. Strokes to write, you know, the different radicals and the different components of a character. And to a degree, like if you can remember, you know, the strokes of those individual components, then when you actually see a character that has all those components, you know how to write the character. And it's super helpful. And sometimes it helps me too, like how to remember characters, just like as I knew the stroke order of all the different components. So, you know, the Heisen method, right? You know, but Stroke Order, I think it's one of those Chinese innovations and inventions of the language, which I think have actually really makes sense on helping you remember how to write the language.
Well, I think it's kind of an emergent property that was really necessary, but people didn't realize until they started going. You know, especially pre-computers, it's quite necessary.
Thank you, Chinese culture, for Stroke Order. All right, John, so what do you have for us today? A rant or a rave?
All right, so I have a rave, and it's related to today's topic, but I'll start out broad and zoom in. All right, you'll see what I mean.
Okay, I'm ready.
So the rave focuses on Chinese parks. If you've
parks.
Ever been to a park.
Gongyuan.
Yes. You will notice that there's lots of interesting things going on. There's the Ais, the old ladies dancing in unison at sundown. There are the Tai Chi lessons when the sun is rising. But one thing that is really cool, which relates to today's topic, is there's also these guys, usually they're old guys, and they have like these special calligraphy brushes, which are like a sponge. And they're using water to write their calligraphy on the ground in the park. And if you haven't seen this and you're going to China, make sure you spend a little time in parks and try to find this because it's so cool.
It is cool. I like those guys. I remember once you had some pictures or so. Some guy was doing, he was like, his form was perfect.
Yeah, there are guys that can, or women too, that can write characters that look like print. There are guys that can use a water spongy brush to write what looks like calligraphy you'd see hanging in a museum. There are guys that use chalk writing on the ground to make these amazing calligraphy works. It's really cool.
I love these guys. You know, in fact, anyone listening, if you get the chance to go to China, just go to the parks. It's like a smorgasbord of entertainment, just watching people and seeing what all sorts of people are doing there.
And it's free. In fact, I've talked to people that come to China pretty regularly. A little shout out to Robin and Jemmy here. And one of the things that they always do is make some time to visit parks and just kind of take it all in because there's lots of cool stuff going on.
So you can go out there and dance with the IEs in the evening, like at maracas sometimes, got their music there.
I think the friend I'm talking about actually does that.
I have a friend here. She's a little bit older, but yeah, she was like really in with the IEs and she'd dance every night with them. Of course, she was like their same age and she got to be like friends with them and they started some sort of dancing troupe. It was funny.
Or if you have little kids who have not yet learned shame, they will go over there and start dancing with them as well, right?
Yeah, it's fun.
That's hilarious.
Got a lot of good pictures of that. John, have you been out dancing with them?
No.
Why not?
I have learned shame.
You have learned shame.
I have learned that I am not a talented dancer as well.
Well, I'd like to see you try.
I know you would.
Chris is one cool cat with some serious Chinese chops.
My mom's from Honduras. My dad's from Chile.
And now you are a professional YouTuber, right?
Yes, you could say that.
Chris has an obvious talent for languages, but as you listen to his story, you'll hear how he took extra steps to grow and develop his Chinese into what it is today. And with that, he's carved out his own career in this world.
I went to school in California. When I graduated, I decided to come out to China for a couple months, actually. I was doing a gap year. I kind of just ended up staying. It's been 8 years now. I started a business. I'm loving it.
His story has something for every one of us. Stay with us. Chris, dude, totally awesome to have you on our show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so okay, you're on vacation right now.
Yes, I'm here in Sanya in Hainan.
This is the Chinese New Year. So what's going on? What are you doing down there?
So I'm here with my wife and my in-laws. We're just down here for about a week or so to get away from the cold in Beijing.
So anyone who hasn't been to Hainan, that's like the resort area. What would we liken it to, Chris?
It's kind of like Mallorca for the Europeans.
Maybe like Cancun for us Americans.
Yes, there we go. It's kind of like Cancun. Very commercialized in a couple areas, but it's a pretty nice place. What I do, I run an education company, and then I make videos for YouTube and then like the Chinese social media sites like Weibo, Bilibili, and Douyin.
And that's crazy because like I went to your YouTube site, and anyone listening here probably has no idea who you are because your YouTube site, it's only Chinese.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's really weird because we had no idea that like people would even watch our stuff on YouTube when we first started out. And then one day a video just took off. Like we make analyses of Chinese celebrities speaking English to kind of help people, you know, maybe with common mistakes that all Chinese people might make. So it's kind of fun and kind of educational at the same time. And a video just took off. Overnight, it was actually the day before my 30th birthday. My business partner and I were in Hawaii, and we just saw like, oh, one of our videos has 100,000 views. What the hell just happened?
Wow.
And just kind of from there, I got like really excited. My business partner was just like, nah, man, like that's, yeah, okay, whatever. Like it's like 500 subscribers. It's not a big deal. Like let's focus on Chinese social media. And then like it just kept growing and it kept growing. And I don't know, like here we are a year later and we're doing all right.
That's pretty cool. So is your biggest following on YouTube or do you have also equal amounts of following on the other Chinese social media platforms?
No, YouTube is actually currently our smallest one. Between Douyin, Weibo, and Bilibili, we have about 2.2 million subscribers on Chinese social media.
Well, that's pretty hefty.
Yeah, it's not bad. Like I always tell people, like, you know, in China, these numbers mean different things. Like 2 million people, it's not a huge account. But I mean, like, yeah, it is. It's 2 million people. You can't say that that's small.
That's true. I mean, when you deal with the numbers in China, it's just on an exponentially larger scale. And you have a good point there. But what would you say 2 million followers in China would be equate to about how many followers in, you know, the Western media?
I usually tell people maybe divide it by 4 or 5, maybe even more, just because there are so many people on just one platform. Like Douyin, which is, I guess, the Chinese equivalent of TikTok, you get people that gain 1 million fans in a week, which is insane. It's unheard of in the West.
Wow, that is significant. Well, Chris, start walking me through this. So you went to university in California, and what did you study there?
I majored in finance, minors in economics, Italian, and German.
So what took you to China?
So it was basically, I wanted to take a gap year, and one of my really good friends who graduated the year before me was in China working, well, he was between China and the US, and his boss sent him to Beijing to take lessons. And he told me one day, like, oh man, Beijing is super fun. It's really international. And like, I love learning languages. I've studied a bunch. And he just said, like, hey, you should come check it out. And actually didn't want to go. Like, I, as a finance major, knew that China was developing really quickly and that it's the place to be, you know, but I'd never been interested in China. So I hesitated a bit, but then I just, hey, you know what, whatever, I'll just go. I was there by myself. I literally didn't know a single other soul. And I just kind of went to a couple of restaurants and like I used the 3.5 sentences that I'd learned of Chinese to try to order food and all this kind of stuff. And like, it was a little overwhelming. Chinese classes started and I just took 4 hours of Chinese classes a day, 2 hours of speaking, 2 hours of reading and writing, and I had a blast. I loved it. It was really fun, but so different from every other language that I'd previously learned myself.
Well, I want to hear now, because you went through this class for 2 months, right?
Yes.
What happened afterwards? 8 years later, you're still in China, but I mean, obviously there's something there that kept you around or piqued your interest.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the first thing was, like I've mentioned that I've studied a bunch of languages. I grew up speaking Spanish at home and I took German classes in high school. I studied Italian, French, and Japanese in college. And when I got to China, I just felt like, wow, this is a completely different ballgame. Like, I don't even know how to approach this. I mean, that in and of itself, like the language aspect was super interesting to me, you know, with tones and characters and all of that. But I started meeting people. For me, like, that's the thing. That's why I learn languages, is just to be able to communicate with other people and understand their culture, like how they think and all that. You know, after those 2 months, I started making a lot of friends. I took the HSK and like I started thinking like, hey, you know what? Maybe this actually could have some like positive implications for my career. But it seemed like, you know, as a finance major, this might be a decent place to be and a good language to learn.
Well, I want to know, like, how was your Chinese progressing at this point? I assume you're gaining some proficiency, but you're still very early on.
About 2 months in, you know, I wasn't really taking the classes seriously. I was hanging out with all these Europeans, Latin Americans. Like, it was just really cool for me as like a language nerd to spend my days speaking Italian, German, English, Spanish. And, you know, I would go home, hang out with my friends, speak those languages, and then I'd get to class the next day and be like, oh, like I didn't do the homework. kind of awkward. But in January, things kind of changed. I started having that little mindset shift that I was mentioning. And as I made friends, like, I started hanging out with them more. So I started hanging out less with Europeans and a little bit more with Chinese people. I still didn't really do my homework, but I was trying to use everything that I learned in class out at the restaurants and bars with my new Chinese friends. So about 7 months in, I took the HSK4 and passed that.
Well, that's great. That's a good benchmark.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the big thing was actually, we noticed that myself and like a couple of our other friends who made Chinese friends, they were the ones that were progressing the fastest.
Mm-hmm.
So like that, I think that's the thing that I always tell people. It's just like, yeah, like you should study from textbooks and stuff like that, but not for too long. Don't spend too much time on textbooks, because otherwise you're going to be learning kind of weird stuff, really formal, stilted speech, and just get out there and talk to people, you know?
What were you actually doing where your Chinese started to really take off?
Well, to be honest, at first I went to a lot of bars and I made a lot of like Chinese guy friends. And that's actually one of the big things that a lot of people always say. She's like, oh, you must have a Chinese girlfriend. That's where your Chinese is so good. Or, you know, reverse it for a Western girl who speaks good Chinese. It's like, oh, you must have a Chinese boyfriend. And I've actually found that it tends to not be that. It tends to usually be, if you made a friend of the same sex, that's what kind of is going to take your Chinese to the next level. So I had like one really good guy friend that I spent a lot of time with. And that was a huge help, just because you can like hang out with, you know, another guy, go grab some beers and like just spend hours together.
That's pretty cool. You know, I like this story, Chris, because this actually parallels a little bit of something that I've noticed about Chinese culture. And maybe you could comment on this, but like when I've read some of like old Chinese fairy tales or fables or stories, they always have this situation of you have like these two guys, they're the two heroes, and one of them's traveling, they run across each other, and it's like they find one thing's in common and they're like, we're going to now be, you know, eternal brothers, right?
it's just
like instant, right? And I've noticed that something that's like not an uncommon thing like in Chinese culture.
Yeah, that's super common. Like when I would go out to bars with people, I would like to go to small places, like not these like huge bars where a lot of foreigners are hanging out with, but actually like, you know, back when Beijing had a lot of hutong bars, you'd go to these places and you sit at a tiny little table with another table, like another group of people next to you. And when you're having a conversation, like some people would hear you and be like, oh, wow, 那边有老外啊,他在说中文啊, wow. And then like, sometimes they'll just like start a conversation and then, you know, you make a new friend. And a lot of times, you know, it might just be a guy that you talk to that day and then like never again. But usually at the end of the night, they'd just be like, oh, 我们现在就是我们是好哥们儿啊，加加点微信，然后咱们就经常联系吧，可以出去喝酒。 So like we're super best friends now. Let's get each other's WeChats. Let's go out, get some drinks. And a lot of times like that never happens, but you know, it's just really cool to meet people like that.
Oh, I've had so many experiences like that too. I think it's kind of funny too, as I look back, and it's not uncommon for like, you know, you meet some girls and, you know, I'm married, but I still have girls ask me for my WeChat all the time. But I honestly have just as many guys asking me for my WeChat, you know, they're like, oh, we should be friends.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, before I started doing social media, where, like, people would just add me and be like, hey, woman, let's become WeChat friends and we can talk. And it's like, sure, random guy I just met, but why not? Okay.
Yeah.
I would never say no back then.
Honestly, this is interesting because I look back on my experience learning Chinese, and you came to China in 2011. That still was QQ time, right? I came to China in 2010, and yeah, I was knee deep in QQ. And WeChat, when did we come out? WeChat, 2015?
Around then.
Okay.
And I remember, because it was just kind of funny, in 2012, one of my Chinese teachers was just like, hey, you need to download this new WeChat thing. It's going to change the world. And everybody's just like, well, what the hell is that? We have QQ. Like, why would we want to download something new?
Yeah.
By the same company? Like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
But I downloaded it, and that was great. Like, that actually really sped up my Chinese learning, just because there's so many people that you could send messages to all the time.
And, you know, when I was talking, when I'd use QQ to communicate or just talk to people, it was a huge help to my Chinese, because, you know, you get to see that in context and you see how people react and how they're using phrases and stuff, and it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing that I always tell people. Like, you know, Chinese people will come up and tell me, like, hey, I've been studying English for 20 years. You've been doing it for 8. Why is your Chinese better than my English? And it's just like, well, input. You know, you need that, you know, what's called comprehensible input, stuff that's like a little bit above your level maybe, but you can go in and see the context, look words up. And I was spending like days, like my entire day would be filled with conversations like that, spoken and over text and everything. And like, that is huge. Like, you need that.
Well, how many months in from studying Chinese did you start to do this, where you're going out and just meeting people in bars and stuff?
It was probably about 4.5 months in. One of my classmates, who's from the Netherlands, he went to this place called Tango. It's like this huge KTV / club. And he met the owner, obviously a Chinese guy. And like, they kept inviting him out to like go play pool and, you know, just have drinks, have dinner. And then like one night he invited me along, and like I went. They were all super nice. And then just from there, I started meeting more and more people.
And where was your Chinese at that point? Because, I mean, after 4.5 months, I mean, it's still quite basic. So what were you saying? How were you trying to communicate? And what was that struggle like?
I mean, it was terrible, you know, like, like everybody is super friendly and nice, and they would slow down their speech a little bit. But, you know, like the average Chinese person, much like the average American, they have no idea how to like, you know, temper their language or just like make it a little bit more basic for somebody who's learning. So sometimes they'd like throw a chengyu at you, or sometimes they just use like a really, I guess, colloquial phrase that's definitely not in the textbooks. But, you know, that kind of sink or swim setting that I was in was just like, okay, well, I'm going to learn a billion words a day. And like, I wasn't actively studying them. It's just, I was exposed to so many different things, and like hearing everybody talk, stuff just starts to stick, you know?
So from this point, like, how did you continue your studies? I know you said you decided to go, hey, 6 more months studying, but you're also just jumping into conversations. So what were you doing to really learn and accelerate your Chinese at this point?
Like I said, I started off doing 4 hours a day of classes. We had like, you know, 6 or 7 people in the class. And after about 4 months, I think, I switched away from the group classes to private classes, because I felt like they were kind of messy. Like, people kept coming and going, and I kind of knew how to study a language already. So like, I wanted to go more at my own pace, which might be like a little bit more accelerated compared to the average person. I had textbooks, you know, like we were just going along. It was the Kouyu Sucheng series that was used by a lot of BLCU classes back in the day. I mean, that was my textbook experience, and then the rest was just out talking to people.
So in your studying at this point, like, what did you find that was effective and what did you find that wasn't effective?
So the thing that I always tell people is, don't spend all your time on textbooks. And I know that you guys did an episode on that.
Yeah, our last episode, in fact.
So many people just look at their textbooks and like, they make word lists and try to memorize vocab, and they never take that out into the real world, or they never try to like really test themselves on it, like out on the front lines. And that for me is the biggest thing, where you have to like actively recall all these phrases and everything that you're learning. So that, I mean, was a huge thing. And like, once you actually start having conversations with people, like, I love imitating people and like just kind of seeing how they speak, finding like their speech patterns and all that kind of stuff. And that's what I started doing. Like, being out at bars and stuff, I would just listen to what word this guy just used. How did he say that? Like, what was he stressing? And, you know, at the beginning, like, I would catch like one word in a sentence, and that might be the key word. It might be completely irrelevant, but like, just paying attention to how they speak is huge, because it's totally different from the textbook.
You know, I agree with that for sure. So I want to know what happened next here in your life. I mean, I can fast forward later and we can see that you've now achieved a high level of proficiency in Chinese. And for anyone listening here, we'll put his YouTube channel in the notes so you can check out. You can see how good Chris's Chinese is. But Chris, like, what happened between then and now where you were able to really take off and improve your Chinese?
All right. So I guess a couple key milestones or key points in my learning. One was shortly after I passed the HSK-4, like I got like a pretty high score on it, and all my teachers were like, wow, like you've only been learning for 7 months and you passed. That's great. That's amazing. And then one of my teachers, he just told me like, yeah, but you know, like you kind of sound like you're from Xinjiang. And like for, it was just like, what? I didn't even know what that meant, to be honest, at the time. So he explained, you know, in Xinjiang, there's the Uyghur ethnic minority, and a lot of them don't speak Chinese as a native language. So they tend to have, kind of similarly to foreigners, a, well, not the most solid grasp on tones. So I asked him, I was like, oh, what do you mean? He's like, oh, well, like your tones are all over the place. Like, huh, okay. Why has no one ever told me this? And he said, well, you know, it's kind of too late now anyway. Which I was just like, what? What do you mean it's too late? I've only been learning for 7 months. Like, anyway, yeah. I decided to like sit down. He wasn't sure at that time anymore. I sat down with somebody and I was like, no, we're going to learn these tones. You're going to teach me. And everybody kept telling me actually like, oh, like, you know, your tones are fine. Like you, they're like 60% there. I was like, that means 4 out of 10 of them are wrong, you know? So I sat down and I spent 2 months. 2 months where like I didn't learn any new textbook stuff. All I did was learn how to pronounce things.
Wow.
Get the tones right, get the pronunciation right. That was 2 hours of class a day, and I would go home and probably do another 2 hours of practice on my own. And all my teachers were just like, well, you're insane. Like there's absolutely no point. You're already, you know, comprehensible, but like that comprehensible doesn't sound that nice.
Yeah.
It just seems like, oh, I can understand you. But I spent those 2 months, and after that, a lot of people who hadn't seen me for 2 months were just like, whoa, what the hell happened? And that for me was like a big turning point, just because pronunciation, like even though, yeah, like you don't need to sound like a native, but if you have something that's closer to a native, people are going to be a lot nicer. Like one, they're like confused and shocked, and two, like they're just going to feel like, oh, like maybe you're more like one of them. And they start treating you differently.
Yeah. So can you share any experiences where people started treating you different because you had a more native-like accent?
So, I mean, one of the things is, you know, a lot of people who come to China and start learning Chinese, 1 day in, 2 days in, a week in, they start realizing like Chinese people are super friendly. Like they're going to hear you say, oh, ni hao. And they're like, oh, wow, ni zhong wen shuo de zhen bang. And like everybody's super complimentary.
Yeah.
But it started just like being a little bit more genuine. Like you could see surprise on people's faces. And they would start inviting me to like all these other cool little places that seemed less like the let me show off my token foreign friend and more like let's just kind of hang out and have a conversation.
So you're able to have like a deeper connections with people. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, and like, I mean, this is something that's been proven time and time again. It's like, yeah, you're totally fine talking to somebody that has a non-native accent. But when you hear your own, you're just like, oh, like, oh, you're from the U.S.? Like, oh, you're German, blah, blah, blah. Like, you get a bit more excited and like you're just like, oh, yeah, like you're one of us. You're like me.
Yeah.
And then I guess fast forward 2 years later, I went and took classes at Tsinghua's IUP program, which is like a more advanced Chinese program. I did that for a semester. And I had actually not learned characters very well. I learned them, but it wasn't like the most systematic way, partially because my first teacher wasn't that great, and partially because I was really lazy in the beginning and I was just hanging out with people, talking. So I kind of ignored characters. Like, I didn't like them. Mm-hmm. They didn't like me. I didn't like them. And then like when I got to IUP, this teacher who, like, I will say to this day, like, he's the best language teacher that I've ever met. Not the best Chinese teacher that I've ever met, but like the best language teacher. Like, I've taken a lot of languages. He was incredibly helpful. He just grabbed a random book. We didn't even use a textbook. He went to his bookshelf and grabbed three books. He was like, oh, this one's about food, this one's about language, and this one's about traveling. Which one do you want to read? I was like, I have no idea. He's like, all right, we're gonna read this book about language. Mm-hmm. And it was just called 文字是肉做的. So, like, I guess, you know, literature is made from meat or flesh, which is, like, you know, made from people. Mm-hmm. So the book was actually a collection of essays written for this column in a Hong Kong newspaper. And it was incredibly difficult. Like, I started reading them and I was like, I can't do this. I was reading one page a day and, like, having to look up everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And the next day, like, the second day of class, I went in and I was just like, no, I'm sorry. Like, Hua Laoshi, like, I can't do this. He's like, yeah, you can. You got this. So, like, we sat down and, like, we went over the previous day's one page of text. He explained everything to me and, like, I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. He would explain all the characters, the background, like, all the components and everything. And he started doing this, and every day for a semester, that's what we did.
Wow.
And at the end of that semester, I was just like, mind blown. I don't know what happened. Like, all of a sudden, I feel like I can read most things. Like, obviously, like, you know, classical Chinese and, like, Cheng Yu and a lot of stuff, that they were still beyond me. But all of a sudden, I felt like I know most of the characters that I see.
Wow.
And I know what they mean. Like, this weird moment where 2 months of classes, and I was just like, all right, something's happened. It just kind of felt like, you know, Neo in the Matrix, where they just put stuff into his head and he's just like, oh, I know Kung Fu.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting to hear, because I work with a lot of Chinese teachers in a lot of elementary and middle school, high schools around the United States. And one of the concepts that I've talked to them about doing reading classes is that a lot of times teachers think, oh, I need to have like a curriculum, you know, I need to have a lessons plans or things like that. And I said, well, what you can do is you just take the textbook, throw it out of the classroom, and you replace it with a story, a novel. And of course, you know, we use graded readers from Manner Companion, but you can do that because you can just go read stuff and you can talk about it. And once you have a story or something interesting, it's now opens up a whole cornucopia of things to talk about and have discussions about. And of course, you can go through and read. And it sounds like the text that she gave you was actually very difficult. And usually, you know, we say, hey, it's better to start something easier, but it's more approachable if you have a teacher who can guide you through it. And that's usually more like guided reading. That's a little bit, sounds to me, what you're describing.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's the whole concept of I plus one, you know, like finding something that's just like a little bit above your level. And that was definitely not I plus one. That was like I plus 100. You know, I had this teacher who was phenomenal. And every day he would just break down the billion words that I wrote down on this one page. And at the end of the day, I would feel like, oh, okay, like, actually, I get what's happening. And I wouldn't recommend this method to most people, like, unless you have a really good teacher who's going to be sitting there with you. But, like, it did just speed everything up, you know, 100 times.
That sounds like it was effective for you. And that's fantastic. So you just picked up a lot of characters from that. And I assume you saw them in context in the book. And it sounded like it was interesting material for you.
I am a language nerd, and like these books were basically talking about how the language has been changing in Hong Kong, how mainland Chinese is different from Hong Kong Chinese in like the writing, and how actually Hong Kong Chinese is getting influenced by English. Stuff that most people wouldn't really like or find interesting, but like I loved it. And if you have a teacher that's going to be taking you through this, then you can choose something that's really hard and way above your level. Otherwise, I would probably just recommend graded readers, because they're going to be so much better at kind of helping you gauge where you're at.
So let's fast forward a little bit here. How did you get started making videos teaching English to Chinese people?
I finished this course in 2014, and actually my friend from college, who's the guy that got me here in the first place, he did that course with me, and then he moved to Zhuhai, like all the way in the south in Guangdong province. We were talking all the time, and we were thinking of starting a business. We had taught a bunch of English, and like I actually helped foreign exchange students with their English back in college. And I saw like how Chinese people learned the language, and I always found it like incredibly ineffective. I thought it was really weird. Like everybody's just sitting there memorizing vocab all day. So we decided like, hey, why don't we kind of start our own business? We can share a lot of our experiences, and especially like my experiences learning a lot of languages. And I'm pretty sure we can do this better. So that was in late 2015 that we started our company, started doing basically offline English classes. And all this time I was also writing a blog. So like what's called a WeChat public account. So it's WeChat's version of your own little website where you can post articles, videos, whatever. And one day this guy at the gym told me like, hey man, like I've heard you're Chinese. Like, why don't you make videos? Let me introduce you to a friend who's another foreigner making videos. So I met this guy, his name's Raz from Israel, who had started a company doing interviews. They would just interview expats living in China out on the street about a variety of topics. And he interviewed me for his show, and he was just like, yo, you need to make videos. You have to. And like that was it. I was just like, nah, man, like I was so scared of the camera. Like, I just couldn't do it. And he just told me, like, no, man, I don't care. Like, your Chinese is so good. Like, you have to try, like, make videos. It's a waste for you to just sit and write articles. Like, what are you doing? So that was it. Like, I downloaded Douyin, like I said, the Chinese version of TikTok, and I posted a video that day.
Wow.
And it didn't do very well. But, like, I just kept going at it. And, like, me and my business partner, we would plan out all our videos, film, edit. We knew nothing about filming or editing. But we started doing it, and like people started watching it. People enjoyed what we were making.
That's a great feeling when, you know, people start like listening or watching what you're doing, right?
Yeah, no, it was super weird because like it was basically, you know, we'd get 100 views, 200 views, 400 views. And the way that Douyin works, it's actually with an algorithm. So it's just based on like how much people watch and like do they engage with it, do they repost it or whatever. And we all of a sudden, I think it was like our fourth video, got 300,000 views.
Wow.
It was me reading a tongue twister in Chinese. And it just like the video just blew up, and we're just like, what the? Okay. Maybe we can make videos.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. And so here you are now, sitting on top of your social media empire.
Well, I wish I could call it an empire.
A dynasty. It's a dynasty.
We're working on it. We're working on it.
Well, Chris, tell us now, if you could go back and start learning Chinese all over again, like what would you do differently?
Number one, and this is what I tell a lot of people, anybody who asks me like how I learned Chinese, it's just learn the tones, please. Please learn the tones right in the beginning, because, you know, a lot of people will find out if they've learned another language in the past, like once you've been doing it for a long time, it's really hard to go back and change stuff after the fact. So learn tones, because you'll hear people that say, oh yeah, like, you know, a lot of Chinese people, their tones are off too, so it's fine. But it's like, no, Chinese people who speak a different dialect, their tones are off because there's a systematic way that their tones change in their particular dialect. So you can kind of see how it changes and it'll be consistent. Whereas with us, our tones will be all over the place and there isn't necessarily the most consistent like rhyme or reason for it sometimes. It's just, you don't know what's going on. You didn't learn the tone. And like, that's going to be one of the hugest things that's going to help you so much in like actually making friends and like talking to people and having deep conversations. Because if you're going out and all you want to do is order a beer, then sure, like go out and say like, oh, Fu Yuan, Yiga Pijo. And they'll know exactly what you're saying because
yep.
That's it, you know? But if you want to have a deeper conversation and talk about like, oh, the, I don't know, the economic climate, or even just like shoot this and talk about the latest movie that you watched, then yeah, your tones better be a bit more on point, because there's going to be a much like wider variety of words that you're going to be using.
So then, Chris, what is the next step for you in your Chinese language?
Well, so, I mean, I guess a lot of people, they hear me and, you know, depending on what context I'm in, a lot of people just think that I'm Chinese or that I was at least born and raised in China. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of my other expat friends that I work with, like they speak Chinese at an equally high level, sometimes even higher. So it's just like an ongoing process. Like even right now where I feel like I don't ever need to look up a word really. Like I can guess just from context. I'm still learning every single day and like I haven't stopped. I'll read stuff out loud. I'll read signs, like every sign or like little slogan that I walk by on the side of the road, like I'll read it out loud and my wife will make fun of me. She's like, why are you reading that? And that's kind of what you need to do. Like if you want to keep improving, like never stop learning, just never stop. And like for me, like I would love to give like a TED talk or something in Chinese, like force myself to actually go and use a little bit more high level language, that type of stuff.
Well, it sounds like that is a goal within your grasp.
Well, I hope so.
Well, Chris, I think it's been really enlightening to hear your experience, and I appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us.
I hope people can learn something from it.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teacher, cousin, transcriber, photographer, Lego master builder, and that one guy named Jimmy. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at MannerCompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is James Harper. I'd like to thank Chris Max and my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasden. See you next time.